Back together again, you and I, with a brand new week, kicking it around on Monday, August the 5th, 2024, on Connecticut Today. I started off the show wondering if Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign can actually go all the way to November without holding a news conference. Commuter advocate Jim Cameron dropped by to talk about the legendary New Canaan Club car that ran at one time on the New Haven rail line, while intellectual property attorney Kristen Roberts discussed the controversial Summer Olympics opening ceremony presentation spoofing the Last Supper.
So there's been no official designation of who's going to be the number two person yet on the Kamala Harris ticket for the November election. We're supposed to find out about that now tomorrow, they say. And all reports indicate it's down to two individuals, the Governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, that will make the far-left part of the Democratic Party apoplectic because Mr. Shapiro is Jewish. He apparently is a practicing Jew, and the rabble-rousers, the Hamas wing of the Democratic Party, have already put Ms. Harris on notice, say, hey, think long and hard before you do this because we may not like that. The other possibility here is the governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, who is an avowed progressive. So either way, by the time we join you tomorrow, I think it'll already be out there. Maybe it'll either be Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, or it'll be Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania. But for now, that is where it stands, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So we're down to two governors here, one from a state that the vice president would definitely need. I don't know how she wins, or for that matter, how Mr. Trump wins without Pennsylvania. It's a very populous state. It's a tough state to win. It's a huge swing state. It's got some very rural, conservative-leaning areas, and it has some very urban, blue-leaning areas. Of course, areas such as Philadelphia in the east and Pittsburgh in the west. So the governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, is being considered there, and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is being considered there. There was talk that Minnesota may have been in play, for the Republicans, but that's really not going to happen. But here's my issue. Now, I think, you know, both sides will play the pluses and minuses of whomever Ms. Harris picks. But here's the bottom line, and the question I will ask, and the question I'll open up with on this Monday: would you be willing to vote for Kamala Harris over Donald Trump? And I know a lot of you will say, listen, I will vote for a dead corpse of any Democrat over Donald Trump. I know that. You've said that in jest and in some seriousness. I've got friends of mine who say that. But you know what? Joe Biden stepped aside. I'm looking at the calendar here, and good for him. We all thought he should do that. Joe Biden stepped aside on Sunday, July 21st. So you've got 1 week there. You've got another week there. That's 14 days, 15 and 16 days. Now, I know I harp on this a lot, but I think it tells you something. Now, here you have Kamala Harris, who had this big kickoff to the campaign. She got tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in free publicity from the local news cycle, the local and national news cycle. We get that. That happens to any major politician. Yet now we are in, let's see, day 7, 14, we are in day 16 since she essentially became the de facto nominee, and she hasn't spoken to the press. So here's my question to you. Would you still be willing to vote for her or vote for any candidate between now and Election Day in November if they didn't have a news conference? And I'm talking about a real news conference, not a friendly panel discussion, not some sort of form. I mean, when you think about it, think about this. And we all know why she hasn't done a news conference. She's not good at it. Now, again, I don't think I'm being harsh here when this is a person that wants to lead the free world. Now, having said that, I know what all of you are saying out there. A lot of you, well, Trump this and Trump that. I'm not talking about Donald Trump. Lord knows he says sometimes things sometimes that make me cringe and make other people cringe. But here's the bottom line. At least he says it. At least he says it in front of cameras and in front of microphones. One thing Donald Trump does not do in any way, shape, or form is hide from the press. Sometimes it's to his detriment. But my God, there are some clips now circulating over the weekend that, and I'll pull a couple of them for you and let you know about this later on in the show. There's some stuff out there that she has said in front of microphones. I mean, it is a word salad. And I'm even reading stuff from, you know, well-known Democratic strategists saying, hey, this ain't going to last. She's going to have to do news conferences. Here's my question. Is she? Or are we going to see a rerun of 2020 when, you know, now they blamed it on COVID, okay, when current President Biden ran a, well, what they called a basement campaign, and it worked. He won. But how do you go, and we know what the answer to this is, just look at any time she's unscripted. It ain't good. She's gone 7, 14, 15, 16 days without a news conference. Now, I know what you're saying. Well, if I could get the free PR, hell, I'd do that too. Yeah, I get that. But there's another reason for that. And again, I'm reading stuff over the last 2 or 3 days. You've got anonymous Democratic strategists saying, yeah, the cringe part is going to come when she actually opens her mouth up in front of a microphone. Now, what's going to happen? This is going to have this big announcement tomorrow. Will she take questions from the press? I don't know. But doing this, see, her campaign people are very smart here, and I guess it's a combination of the Obama and Clinton people there saying, hey, you ride this as long as you can. I mean, it's been an orgasm of coverage, trembling loins of coverage, for the mainstream media, the same media that was actually around for about a week questioning the White House about Joe Biden. Now that he's gone, the poor guy, I actually feel sorry for him. He got kneecapped there. Now you have a nominee who didn't run in any primaries, and she's not talking to the press. Now, here's my question. Does that matter to any one of you? And it may not, and God bless you if it doesn't. Frankly, I don't care. But I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day. We were messaging, and he is on the polar opposite pole that I am politically. As right of center as I am, he is left of center. But guess what? We're still friends, because we know in the end we're all going to die, and it's all full of crap, and nobody's getting out of here alive. But I texted him the other day. I said, do you think she can really go all the way and not do any sort of an aggressive news conference? He said, yeah, maybe. Shouldn't really have to. See, that's the whole thing. I wonder if people, and again, there's stuff Trump says, and I go, oh, not good. But at least he says it. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. If you are running for the White House, wouldn't you, knowing you have an opponent out there that about half of the country would still vote for at any given time, wouldn't you have maybe 2 or 3 days after you became the de facto nominee have sent out a notice, hey, there's an open news conference with Vice President Harris, all networks, all wire services, whatever newspapers, when they put this stuff out, you know, the news conference. How about a prime time news conference? Why not do that? Well, all you have to do is look up some of the stuff she said in the past. There's a clip out there right now of her trying to, this may be AI, I don't know. I'm kind of hoping it is. There is a clip out there of her trying to explain cloud storage. And you know what cloud storage is? It's when your computer information is not stored on your premises or on any sort of an extension hard drive you have on your machine, or any sort of a backup system that depends on you physically having the data there. It's in the cloud. They call it the cloud. It's not really in the clouds. It's a remote server. She couldn't say that. And again, I'm not hammering her because she's a woman, because she has a mixed ethnic racial makeup. To me, I couldn't care less if she's a tree and she's got the genetic makeup of 14 animals. I don't care. What I'm wondering is, and maybe you don't have to wonder, maybe this is rhetorical in me asking this, why hadn't she spoke to the media yet? Why wouldn't you do that? You think you know? I do. Maybe she's not really good. Maybe all this excitement is because of her gender. Honestly, when you think about it, what did she achieve in the Senate? Now, you could ask, what did Donald Trump achieve, too, before that? Okay, that's fair. People can make their own rational and irrational judgments on that. But again, I'm kind of urging people out there, and it doesn't mean you have to love Trump. You could vote for Bobby Kennedy. You could vote for Dr. Cornel West. You could vote for Jill Stein. You could vote for whomever the libertarian candidate is. I forget his name, you poor libertarians. Like Trump said, you get your 3%, you never win anything. But having said that, would you feel comfortable if every word you heard from Kamala Harris, maybe, I don't know whether this is going to happen, I don't think it will, but can she go all the way, we got what, about 90 days to go here, August, September, October, to November, right? All of August, all of September, all of October. In fact, 3 months from today, yeah, look at that. What about if over the next 90 days, Kamala Harris never held a news conference? I don't think that's going to happen, but it could. Does it matter? Does she have to actually give concrete answers to questions? Like, what would she say today about the economy and the way the markets are crashing? What would she say about the whole situation now ramping up again between Israel and now Hezbollah in southern Lebanon? What would she say about that? I mean, man, they showed her welcoming the hostages home the other day, the released prisoners from Russia, and she said like four sentences and she read it. Yes. All right. See, look, some people can be very accomplished in life and not necessarily think well on their feet. Well, how do you know that, Paul? Well, she hasn't showed it to me. She's really good in front of a teleprompter, and sometimes she's good at these forums and panel discussions. I want to see the White House press corps go after her, a la Richard Nixon, and see what happens. So the next time you are maybe on Metro North, heading up and down the New Haven line, maybe all the way into Grand Central, between Grand Central and New Haven, which prior to COVID I was doing two or three times a week on all kinds of weird hours for the better part of, 13 years or so. Gladly that's ended. The next time you're doing that, ask yourself what you would pay, how much you would pay if you had to do that every day and have your own car. You have your little train club. It's a private car. It's got nice, comfy furniture with drinks in the afternoon, with breakfast in the morning. You say, well, how could that happen? Well, it used to happen, apparently. I love this column. Our buddy, our pal, Jim Cameron, joins us once again, talking transportation. You see his column on a regular basis in the Connecticut Mirror, among other places. Mr. Cameron, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, sir, and yourself?
I'm good. Jim, I wonder if, and tell my listeners about this service, I wonder if there would be any takers for that today, which used to be, I guess, a haven of those, particularly in the New Canaan area. I remember when you ran this column previously, and you ran it again. It's a great story, Jim, that I don't think enough people know about. So explain this.
Well, going back to the good old days of the New Haven Railroad, before Metro North even came into existence, from 1908 until 1976, there was a private club car that was pulled by New Haven trains from New Canaan to Grand Central and back again in the evening. There were also club cars similar to this, I think, that served Larchmont. I believe people have told me there was another one on a different train that stopped at Greenwich as well, too. But here's the deal. These cars did not have 3 and 2 seating. They didn't have 2 and 2 seating. They had individual comfy plush couches and an attendant. Because these cars were actually operated for the railroad by the Pullman Corporation, there was a Pullman car attendant. His name was Willie Spaulding, and he worked on that car for 26 years.
Wow.
And in the morning, the members, they all had to be members of this group to get into the car, the members would be served continental breakfast, and on their ride home in the evening after a hard day in the office, they would have adult beverages.
Shocking.
The car only seated 60 people, and membership in this little prestige organization was not cheap. The initiation fee back in the 1960s was $200. That's about $1,900 in today's money.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a monthly surcharge of $100, say, you know, another $1,000 or so, on top of the price of the rail fare itself. I found all of the documentation on this at the New Canaan Historical Society, which has preserved the archives of this prestigious group. The rumor I'd heard was that it was men only. Well, I read the bylaws, and there was nothing in there that discriminated against women. There were just no women members. Now, remember, this is going back a few years when women were not, you know, in the workplace, and certainly not maybe at CEO level to be able to afford that kind of luxury.
Mm-hmm.
But women were allowed in the car as guests with permission.
Ah.
And the members of this club car community from New Canaan, they held fabulous parties. There were birthday parties holiday parties, and they just carried on. It was like, you know, the good old days. Well, along comes the formation of Metro North, the replacement of the heavyweight cars by the all-electric M2 cars, the old, you know, red cars on the outside. And Metro North said that they would be willing to rebuild a car for the community, but it was going to cost $70,000. This is in 1976 money. That's like a year's salary.
Wow.
And that was a little too rich even for the Tony crowd from New Canaan. And then Governor El Grasso said the state will not be subsidizing millionaire commuters in private cars. So the last private car ran in 1976. When the train arrived home in New Canaan, they had a party on board until into the wee hours of the morning. And the next day, all the members came down and stripped the car of its furnishings.
Wow.
They were all owned by the club. All those club car seats, bridge tables, smoke stands, ashtrays and stuff, they went into storage. And they'd run out of money. So by 1979, the storage fees had drained the treasury. Everything was sold at auction, and poof.
Gone.
The club car from New Canaan was just a part of history.
You know, and that is great. And folks, check out Jim's column on this in the Connecticut Mirror and other spots. You know, Jim, you wonder. And I'm reading this and just smiling and thinking about the conversations and the smoke and the drink and everything.
Yes.
That must have been a bear to clean. But anyway, you know, you wonder maybe to not this extent, Jim, but you wonder if Metro North offered, geez, I don't know, some sort of upscale, dare we say, service on specific trains in one or two specific cars for X amount of money per year, whether it's wider seating, whether it is food, whether it's communal mixing there, whatever. You wonder if anybody would pay for it. Do you think that would fly today or not?
I think it absolutely would work, but this is now a, you know, a public transit agency. And I don't think they're going to, I don't think the state is going to have its finger associated with pushing a button on anything that's going to create an elite class of commuters, especially when the rest of the schlubs are just sitting in there crammed in 3 and 2 seats, maybe with air conditioning, maybe not. So, yeah, the days of this thing, I think, have passed. Now, Amtrak does offer, you know, first class accommodations at outrageous prices. But most of the people that are paying for those, they're not paying for it themselves. You know, they're on an expense account and, you know, their boss is going to pick it up and just bury it as a cost to, you know, the operations. But yeah, I think that there is a demand, or there would be a demand if they had the guts to try offering it for something a little bit better.
Yeah.
I mean, there's even been discussion about, you know, if they start running more express trains, maybe charging a surcharge for express trains.
Yeah.
So if you're coming from New Haven, you don't have to make every single stop until Stamford. Would you pay a little bit more to get in a little bit faster? Sure, if it delivered on that promise.
Yeah. Now, weave that in, Jim Cameron, with the idea of, say, Foxwoods or Mohegan Sun supplying wagering options on the car. I mean, what? There's your natural tie-in. What do you think? I'm an ideas guy, Jim. What do you think?
Well, yeah, you're easy with the ideas. It's the execution that's hard, Paul.
Now, wait a minute. Where did you place that bet? Did you place that bet in Greenwich or over the line in New York?
Right, yeah. And I don't want to see them try to, you know, balance a roulette wheel on a moving train or something. Yeah, I think that the casinos would probably like to keep you trapped in their property so that you're not going to, you know, just ride on the train and run out of money by the time you get to 125th Street and get detrained or something.
Yeah, I love
that.
But
remember the old, bar car?
Oh yes, I wish I could have got on that one. Just Jim Cameron to experience that. Yeah, I wish I did.
Well, there were bar cars on Metro North until 2014, and Metro North was the last commuter railroad in the United States that had bar cars. They were in terrible shape. They were being held together with, you know, duct tape and baling wire and stuff. They decided they didn't want to replace them. They were not making as much money as they'd hoped because they had carts at the end of the track in Grand Central that were selling, you know, adult beverages then. That's gone away since as well, too.
And I was told
the bar cars were another one of those amenities.
Yeah.
You know, now it's got to, you know, it's a BYO. You got to pick up something in Grand Central on the way to the train.
And I was told once by a couple of law enforcement people, Jim Cameron, that, you know, when the bar cars were still around, I think I was actually on one before they got rid of it, only because it was a spillover of people on the train. But, your local police constabulary used to, you know, okay, he's getting out of the bar car now. He doesn't look too steady. Oh, and he's getting in his car at the train station. So, you know, that was something that they did watch. Jim, before we let you go, I want to get your opinion on that story that you may have seen that was floated a couple of weeks ago. And listen, just the permitting on this, Jim, would take 500 years. But this notion about building a tunnel from Port Jefferson to, where was it, Milford, I think, which I think is a grand idea for rail here. But you know, maybe, Jim, our great-great-great-grandchildren can experience something like that.
No, they're not going to experience that because it's never going to happen. It doesn't make sense. It was an idea by Amtrak to find a faster way between New York and Boston. And rather than just coming up the existing tracks or even building new tracks, they thought about the idea about going from Penn Station out onto Long Island to serve some of the communities on Long Island, and then hanging a hard left, going under Long Island Sound, and then joining up with the main line again somewhere around, as you say, I think it was Milford or New Haven or someplace like that. Just prohibitively expensive. It's a very expensive proposition to drilling tunnels underneath Long Island Sound. So, and the time savings just wouldn't have really, you know, made it feasible. So, no, I think we can all dream, Paul, but ideas are easy, but execution is hard.
Absolutely. Folks, check out this column from Jim Cameron, the story of New Haven's legendary club car number 5113. Jim Cameron, as always, good to talk with you. Jim, take care, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Be well.
All right, appreciate it. We talked about this story, I guess, about a week and a half ago, when the Olympics kicked off. Now, the Vatican has finally commented on the controversial drag performance at the start of the Olympics, which apparently mocked the Last Supper painting. Now, remember originally they said, well, this has nothing to do with the Last Supper. It's, and I had friends saying, no, you right-wing jerk, with all the love in the world. No, this is some sort of mythology. And then the producer came out about 2 days later and said, yeah, well, you know, maybe it was the Last Supper. The Vatican said the performance, which sparked outrage worldwide, showed a lack of respect. It's also raising awareness about how iconic works of art, which are not in the public domain, are still considered intellectual property, and variations could be hit with copyright lawsuits, believe it or not. Our next guest can talk about that. She's an intellectual property attorney who deals regularly in the fields of trademark and copyright registration, licensing enforcement, and litigation. Adjunct law professor, too, teaching various intellectual property courses, heavily involved in the community, and her cases have involved big transactions with companies like Target, Walmart, Lululemon, Chipotle, and more. Kristen Roberts is the guest. The online site is Trestle Law, T-R-E-S-T-L-E, law.com. Hey, Kristen, it's Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me today.
Okay, so this is an iconic piece of art, and it turns out in the end, after a couple of days of hemming and hawing, okay, maybe we did try to poke fun at the Last Supper, but it was inclusive, la, la, la. Okay, you look at artworks like that, which we've all seen growing up. Who has the rights to those? Is it a familial thing? Is it who owns the painting? Outline this case a little bit, or a pseudo case involving something like this.
Sure, and that's a really great question, because I think the answer to that question comes down to, well, where is the case being brought? If we're talking here in the United States, we're talking about whether or not the piece of artwork falls into the public domain, and it does under our laws. But countries like Europe and, countries in Europe, mm-hmm. like France and Italy, for example, Italy has very, very strict laws when it comes to their artwork that go beyond what our laws are here in the United States, because their work is considered to be part of their culture. It's not just a piece of artwork that was put out. This is culturally significant. So their protections go a lot further than ours go here in the United States. But if we're talking here in the U.S., public domain, yeah, you can use it. You can comment on it. Parody matters. Our founding fathers, they put First Amendment free speech, that includes art, with freedom of religion, because they wanted to be able to have both in an open culture and society. But in countries like France and Italy, where the art is part of the culture, those laws aren't as protective as they are here.
So could Kristen conceivably some Catholic group or Catholic Church group say in Italy or France or a European heavily Catholic country say, hey, we understand what you were doing. We're not happy with it. So here comes the initial letter from our attorneys. Is that possible over there?
Well, not only is it possible, but it's already happened previously. So there was a case in 2022 involving Jean-Paul Gaultier. Mm-hmm. He was using the Birth of Venus, you know, the Botticelli painting with the woman and the, he was using that, that in a capsule collection as part of his fashion collection in 2022. Mm-hmm. And it was advertised as a tribute to the art, but it ended up getting him sued by the landscape and cultural heritage code enforcers in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So it already does happen. And the same thing happened with the Mona Lisa. This one was a case in France.
Oh, wow.
Someone took the Mona Lisa and then took almost like a, it wasn't a Lego, but it looked kind of like the Duplo version.
Yeah.
And they made a Mona Lisa duplicate of it. And France said, parody exists. That's true. And we want to protect parody. But when you are only doing it to copy it, you're not creating anything new from it. That's when we're going to say all you're doing is trying to commercialize something that already exists. And so they want to protect those works of art in that way. Now, in this case, I think that we see a little, it goes a little bit further than just copying. They are parodying it. So I do think it's worth exploring whether or not parody makes sense in terms of the application. But whether or not they could get in trouble, the laws are different in Europe than they are here in the United States.
Intellectual property attorney Kristen Roberts is the guest. So in Europe then, Kristen, and I guess it would change from art piece to art piece. So the governments or the art commissions, as you say, they would be the plaintiffs here if what? There's no lineage directly from the artist or the sculptor that wants to take legal action here? Do we know whether any of these art cases or any cases like this were superseded by a governmental authority, even over, you know, the lineage of who produced them or not?
Yeah, so these are actually cases that are brought, from what I understand, cases brought by the government. These are not cases brought by the individual descendants of these artists, because the government, for all intents and purposes, own these pieces of artwork, right? They are the ones that have the, you know, they're the ones that want to preserve it for the culture, for the history of their countries. And so they have the vested interest in protecting it. They also have these things called moral rights overseas. We have them a little bit here in the United States, but not so much. It's kind of like what you're insinuating. Does the artist have the right to protect their reputation?
Yeah.
And in Europe, those rights are a lot stronger than they are here in the United States.
Interesting. You know, finally, Kristen, does a lot of this just happen because there is no honesty up front here? I mean, we went for a couple of days and I had, like I said, my friends, you know, yelling at me in a fun way, saying, well, you obviously don't understand, do you? You rogue, you know, you know, artwork and everything. I said, okay, but it kind of looks like The Last Supper, doesn't it? So, you know, in a case like this, would the organizers have just been better coming out of the beginning, as they did, like 2 days later, say, all right, you got us. It was tongue-in-cheek. But as they also said, this has been done before. Should you just be honest right up front?
Well, I think that that's a hard question to answer, only because a lot of people go into making something like this. It's not just one person's decision saying, I'm going to make this to look like The Last Supper. I think there were a lot of things that went into this. I do think it evokes Dionysus, like they originally were talking about. But that's because a lot of the themes in The Last Supper painting are used throughout art. There's not, you know, people sitting at a table is a very common theme in art pieces. Yes, Da Vinci made it famous and made it very famous, but there are other famous works of art that feature similar themes that could have also been said to have been taken from this. So I don't necessarily think it's about honesty. I think it's about not having, quite frankly, a good enough PR department to put something together that, you know, that was really, though, because if you're going to do something that's controversial, if you're going to do something that's going to get people talking, and that was the point, right?
Yeah.
They wanted to get people talking. And boy, did they do that. But they should have had a really good, you know, piece put together, ready to go, to face that, and I don't think they really did. I think they were playing catch up.
Yeah, it's kind of like, to me, just one last thing here, Kristen, it kind of sounds like to me when a music artist gets sued by somebody else who says, hey, that sounds a lot like my song, and they'll go to court and say, listen, I didn't mean it to sound like your song. And then they're always asked on examination, well, you know, did you ever hear something like this? So I guess this is why some artists give a writing credit to somebody, say, let's just get this out of the way in case we're sued here, because of the idea of, well, they may have seen this or heard this in the past.
Well, that's exactly right. You're right on point. Parodying art is a lot like remixing a classic song. You can kind of add your own twist. But if you distort the original too much or disrespect its meanings, you're going to get fans of the original. You're going to make them upset. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it's going to land you in court.
The website is trestlelaw.com, T-R-E-S-T-L-E-L-A-W, trestlelaw.com. Attorney Kristen Roberts. Kristen, thank you. Great stuff, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Paul. Have a nice day.
Appreciate it. Take care. Attorney Kristen Roberts, an intellectual property attorney who deals regularly in specialized fields of trademark and copyright, registration, licensing, enforcement, and litigation.